Well, good evening and welcome to another 2 hours of Jewish soul music. I'm your host, Charlie Bernhout. Each week I try to bring you the best in the whole mixture of Jewish music, and this evening we'll be concentrating on Chazanis because of Sfira. And the regular programming should return next week. Lag BaOmer is next Sunday, so the period up until Lag BaOmer will have been special, and hopefully on the 23rd I'll be here to give you a taste of the old programming. Don't forget that next Sunday there's a special Lag BaOmer cantorial concert at Temple Hillel in North Woodmere. It will feature cantors Yaakov Motzen, Moshe Shulhoff, Shlomo Guber, and I believe it's his son David Guber. The Gubers are from Netanya, and the concert will begin at 7 o'clock. Once again, that's at Temple Hillel in North Woodmere. And don't forget, on June 15th, at Temple Beth Shalom in Lawrence, Ichemir Helfgott, Binyamin Muller from Antwerp, David Burson will make an appearance. He's the cantor at the Jewish Center. And, of course, the chazan of Temple Beth Shalom, our friend cantor Joel Kaplan, will be appearing, and the Jesse Aronson Choir. That's always a sellout, so I suggest if you haven't purchased your tickets yet that you do so. Okay, what else? Let's see. The program this evening, I'll just give you a heads up. The first half hour will be a lot of Moshe Kusevitzky. The second half hour, second half of the first hour, it's an interview with Aharon Pulver of the Israel Independence Fund. The second hour will feature cantors Yehoshua Vider, cantor Yossel Rosenblatt, a magnificent new recording that our friends at Aderet, Mendy Werdiger, put out. And if there's time, we'll play some of Shalom Katz. If not, we'll play Shalom Katz next week. So that's the deal. Let me just give you a heads up. I'll tell you more about this during the second hour, but in 2 weeks from now, I will be in Israel for 2 weeks, and I am preparing some absolutely dynamite programs. First of all, on the 30th, will be a rebroadcast from something I did 20 years ago in 1991, a two-hour Friday evening davening of Kabbalah Shabbos and the Maariv. And then the following week will be a dynamite program, if I do say so myself, of the Shabbos Musaf. This was put together by my dear friend, Yossi Beer, and it has become a classic over the years. But for those of you who are somewhat new, you weren't listening 20 years ago, this promises to be a collector's item. I'll tell you more about that during the second hour. Okay, the first half of this first hour will be devoted to cantor Moshe Kusevitzky. I haven't done this for a while, so let's hear some of his background. He was born in 1899. He died in 1966. He was ranked with the great names of the golden age of cantorial art, Rosenblatt, Sirota, and Kvartim. He was born into a family of Chazanim in Smorgon, a small town on the Russo-Polish border, in 1899. After World War I broke out, he moved with his family to Rostov, and then in 1920 he settled in Vilna. He had been singing and studying since the age of 8. He became the cantor of the Savel Synagogue in Vilna, and in 1925 at the Great Synagogue, where Reutemann, Sirota, and Hirschman had previously served. In 1928, when Sirota left the Tlamaka Synagogue in Warsaw, Kusevitzky was selected to replace Sirota. Over 200 cantors had vied for the position. In Warsaw, Kusevitzky achieved his first real greatness. His voice reached its full power and brilliance as he continued his studies. He gave concerts in Paris, Vienna, Budapest, Brussels, Antwerp, and London. He made two trips to Palestine in 1934 and 1936. By the way, yes, that's our Palestine. His debut in the United States came in 1938 at Carnegie Hall to resounding critical acclaim. Many American synagogues sought his services, but despite all offers, he decided to return to Warsaw and thus was caught up in the overwhelming Nazi Holocaust in Poland. As the Nazis bombed Warsaw in 1939 and the city became more and more fearful, Kusevitzky conducted regular services in shelters and cellars. Practically his last act in beleaguered Warsaw before its surrender was to chant the Yom Kippur services underground. The congregation was even joined by some despairing Christians. Arrested by the Gestapo, Koussevitzky was scheduled to be sent to Awesome Treblinka prison. The Nazis even released a false report that he had been executed. However, he was rescued by non-Jewish members of the Polish underground who recognized his importance as an artist. Dressed in Nazi uniforms, they appeared at the prison with forged papers and spirited Koussevitzky away over the River Bug to Bialystok in Russian territory. Happily, his family was rescued soon after and reunited with him. Now he began a second new career, that of a Russian concert and opera star, in a life literally snatched from death. Koussevitzky gave recitals of operatic and liturgical music in Moscow, Leningrad, Kiev, Odessa, and Tiflis. As the war moved on to Russian soil, he traveled further and further eastward in Russia, almost to the borders of Afghanistan, giving stirring inspirational concerts to the troops under his sponsorship of the Ministry of Education. He received the Stalin Order of Merit for his contribution to the war morale. In 1944, after the German retreat, he became the principal tenor in the Tiflis National Opera Company in the Caucasus, and sang there most successfully for 2 years. After the liberation of Warsaw, Koussevitzky returned to the heartbreaking ruins of the ghetto, where he chanted Kail Mole at a memorial service before the survivors of Nazi horror. The chaos and destruction in the city that had once been the scene of his great triumphs filled him with despair for the future, which seemed hopeless. However, after a concert for the Polish parliament, which is attended by many high-ranking dignitaries of the government and the diplomatic corps, he succeeded in obtaining precious visas for himself and his family, one for England and one for the United States. In London, in 1946, there was a Koussevitzky family reunion for his three brothers, Jacob, Simcha, and David, who had begun careers as cantors in England. His mother and the three brothers had all safely survived the war in London. Koussevitzky gave several concerts in England, concluding with a gala farewell appearance before an audience of 10,000 at the Royal Albert Hall in London. And he finally came to the United States to settle in 1947. Here began Koussevitzky's third rise to the very pinnacle of cantorial glory. His miraculous survival through the bitter war years enlisted great waves of sympathy. He was met at the pier by a tumultuous crowd, and his first cantorial appearances drew throngs of emotional worshipers who wept for him and with him as a remnant of the once great Jewry of Poland. His New York debut before a sold-out house at Carnegie Hall on October 4th, 1947, led a critic for the Times to write, quote, "He proved the possessor of one of the outstanding voices of the time, splendid quality throughout his wide range, powerful, resonant, and rich." For the next 5 years, he officiated for the holidays at important synagogues and gave concerts throughout the United States and Canada. In 1952, he accepted a post at the Bethel Synagogue in Borough Park, Brooklyn. Here, he officiated until his death in 1966. In 1953, he participated in an unusual recital with his three brothers at Carnegie Hall. Sholem Sekunda, Jewish composer, conductor, and critic, then remarked, "To my knowledge, it is rare that four brothers should all become famous cantors. That they should appear together like this is a historic moment in Jewish music." Yes, people still talk about that Carnegie Hall concert. There's a whole mystery as to whether there is a recording floating around someplace. Perhaps somebody is sitting on it, but so far it has not been revealed. No, it has not been revealed. Okay, let's get to Hashem Moloch. This is a classic Moshe Koussevitzky.
Hashem Moloch Geus Loveish Loveish Hashem Ois Yisazah Mighty Kovnet vel, Mal, Mal. coin, pièce comme os, may all may
thrilling voice of Moshe Kuzovitsky. The next selection will be Hashkivenu. I know I have it here someplace. And let's see. There it is. By the way, Paul and Shaya, we missed you last night at the Sidoro dinner. Wish you both a refuah shlema. Let's go to Moshe Kuzovitsky, Hashkivenu.
Hashkivenu Adoshem Eloi Kuvenu Marquevenu,
Moshe Kusevitsky with Hashki Venu. We'll next hear Kol Dodi with the great MK.
השגיאה ולחלה אלייס הייצית ולחרקים הנה זה אוי מיד אחר כוס לנה השגיאה ולחלה אלייס הייצית ולחרקים
Okay, Moshe Kusevitzky with Kol Dodi, and here is a caviar.
Oh
journey to Israel?
Well, I was born in the Bronx. I grew up in the Bronx, Pelham Parkway. And throughout my youth, I was always conscious of being Jewish, being part of a nation. And I was always conscious about Israel. I grew up in a home that was a very warm Zionist home. I remember my father, may he rest in peace, had a synagogue in Pelham Parkway, always made the annual appeal for UJA Federation. And as a young kid, I always dreamed about moving to Israel, and when I was 18 years old, I did it.
Really? How many years ago was that?
Oh, that was a long time ago, okay. Charlie. That was okay. Back in 1973.
73, okay. 27, 38, 38 years. Okay, got
it. My 50s.
Okay, got it.
And I've been there ever since, and I love every minute of it. Living in Israel is like living in a Jewish laboratory. It's an experiment that changes every day. It's dynamic, it's vibrant, and it's thrilling. It's enthralling to live there.
Yes, and frustrating too, I'm sure.
On many occasions, absolutely.
Unfortunately.
It's always challenging.
Yes. What is the Israel Independence Fund?
The Israel Independence Fund was created back in 2007 as a philanthropic umbrella for patriotic Israeli organizations that are dedicated to strengthening Israel's Zionist and Jewish core. Over the past decade, Charlie, we've seen over $250 million pour into Israel from the Ford Foundation, from the European Union, from independent European nations like Norway and Sweden and Switzerland and Spain, in order to fund a cultural shift in our country, for one very simple reason. Anti-Zionists have come to the astute conclusion that they can't beat us on the battlefield. Tank against tank, thank God the Jews always win with a lot of help from above. However, if you take $250 million in a short period of time, in a decade, and attempt to create a cultural shift anywhere, you'll have success. By paying for a constant barrage of anti-Zionist propaganda, by actually paying playwrights and musicians and cultural organizations to begin to think differently, to begin to package Zionism differently, to begin to dilute things from the base, mm-hmm. so that ultimately the entire core is weakened. And unfortunately, Charlie, what we're seeing now is that there is a broad spectrum of people in Israel who question Zionism, who question the purpose of Israel. And that's something that causes us great concern, and it's something we seek to address by fighting back on a philanthropic level.
Of course, they're aided and abetted by the New York Times and other unfortunate media outlets here in this country.
Well, you know, Charlie, you can't expect American media outlets to understand the Middle East. The Middle East has different rules. And I'll give you an example. Many times I explain to friends here in the United States who assume that our neighbors are much like the Finns and the Norwegians and the Swiss, that in Arabic culture, which is very much an oral tradition, gross exaggeration is not considered a lie. So if you say the fish was 5 foot long, instead of relating to the fact that you actually caught a minnow, then that's not a lie but a gross exaggeration that's told for the verbal narrative. In fact, what the New York Times may report on the Middle East and other prestigious American newspapers may report on the Middle East actually reflect the Arab narrative of gross exaggeration rather than the truth. I find that when I read the New York Times, when it comes to the Middle East, as when it comes to the recent articles about a anti-Zionist named Kushner receiving a degree from CUNY, they've got it all wrong simply because their perspective is completely skewed.
Right. Well, we stopped reading the New York Times many years ago. I just couldn't take the the aggravation, quite frankly.
Aside from which, I just noticed that it's $5 a pop on Sundays.
Oh, really?
That's kind of an expense. That's paying somebody to abuse you.
Okay. So now you're an umbrella organization?
That's correct. We're a IRS recognized 501c3, and mm-hmm. all your listeners could visit our site, our website at www.fundisrael.com.
F-U-N-D...
FUND Israel.com.
No, two in there, just Fund Israel?
That's correct.
FundIsrael.com, okay.
And they'll be able to see that we fund different organizations throughout Israel that are very carefully vetted and chosen in order to provide people with strategic philanthropic focus on strengthening Israel, creating a more secure Israel, creating a more Jewish and Zionist Israel, creating a more patriotic Israel, and in fact securing Israel's tomorrow so that my grandchildren and your grandchildren will have a Jewish state to be proud of.
Okay. Tell us specifically some of the organizations.
A good example of what we do is a new up-and-coming organization in Israel called Irgun HaShomer HaChadash, the New Guardian Organization. The New Guardian Organization was established by a number of young guys who had just been released from their compulsory military duties, primarily in outstanding combat units in the IDF. And they came home to their kibbutzim and moshavim in order to discover that their agricultural lands had been stolen by Bedouin tribes in the area. And despite the fact that in some cases there were over 200 documented requests put into the local police force to free the land of illegal Bedouin squatters and ensure that kibbutznikim and moshavnikim could in fact farm the land without threat of arson from these thieves, the police did nothing.
This is in the Galilee?
This is both in the Galilee and in the Negev.
And in the Negev, uh-huh.
And these young men who had just spent 3 to 5 years fighting for their country in the most dangerous units in the army could not believe their eyes when they saw complete police tolerance for the theft of their land. In addition to which, let's be honest and let's be clear, these were not cases of poverty-stricken Bedouin taking a couple of square feet here and there to grow vegetables for their starving families before, you know, anybody on the loony left starts screaming that this is a racist issue. This was a clear political attempt by a population in Israel, well funded by money that's pouring over Israel's borders, cash coming from the Gulf states, in order to drive the Jews off their land. Very much like those who believe that they could fund a cultural shift and convince the Jews that Zionism is no longer important to our national survival, these people are getting unlimited funds from the Gulf in order to burn us off our land. Hmm. And if there is police tolerance for this, then there has to be complete intolerance from same patriotic Jews who understand that the battle lines are drawn throughout the country and we won't let it happen. So these young gentlemen literally ride through the fields on horseback at night in order to protect their land.
I find it interesting that there are many Israelis who are not aware of even that problem, because the Israeli media apparently doesn't seem to think it's that important. I was in Israel last year, and a dear friend of mine for the last 40-50 years, I was telling him about this, and he said, it's impossible, you're just inventing this. And 3 days later he called me and apologized, because there was an article about the Shomrim on television, and he was flabbergasted to see that it really is the fact. And he lives in Carmiel, right up there in the middle of all this.
Interestingly, several days ago before I came to the United States, I was in Carmiel. And Carmiel is a city that, thank God, is expanding. Mm-hmm. But next to the new neighborhoods of Carmiel, which are expanding quickly, we see illegal Bedouin encampments building illegal homes right next to the building sites in order to intimidate the local municipality to compensating them so that contractors can continue to build. What we're seeing is tolerance for Arab lawlessness. What we're seeing is tolerance for capital pouring in from Israel's enemies in order to steal our land, to burn us off our land. And let's be honest, if we're going to talk about, you know, how people view it, the problem is not only the New York Times and loony left-wing papers in the United States that fall into a trap of being anti-Zionist because it's popular and in vogue. The problem is also partially here in the United States on higher levels. For instance, when an American president appears in an Arab capital and gives a speech and directly relates the establishment of the State of Israel to the Holocaust. Now, none of us will deny that the horrors of the Holocaust certainly have a part in the establishment of the State of Israel. But the basic fact is that the Jewish people have lived in the land of Israel uninterrupted for 3,700 years. We're the oldest tribe on the block.
And not only that,
that narrative is not understood not only by people here in the United States, but by the same Israelis who are not aware of the fact that people are stealing our land within Israel. So one of the things that the Israel Independence Fund does, for instance, is we take young Israeli soldiers to visit a unique site in the Galilee, a small village called Pki'in.
But how do you spell that?
Pki'in? Well, I can spell it for you easier in Hebrew than I could in English. But in English, it would probably be spelled P-E-Q-U-I apostrophe I-N.
Pki'in, okay.
Pki'in.
Okay.
And the ancient village of Pekin is unique because it has a Jewish population that was never exiled. There are families, Jewish families living in Pekin, who have been there, and it's documented from time immemorial. And if you ask them, are they Sephardi, or are they Ashkenazi, or are they Yemenite, or are they North African, they're none of the above. They are the real thing. They are Jews who have never left the land of Israel from the time of Abraham. And they exist. And I urge all your listeners, next time they're in Israel, to visit the ancient synagogue of Pekin. We bring 18,000 IDF soldiers there a year.
Really?
Because they heard that speech in Cairo. They heard that the great American president believes that the Jews got there in 1945. We have to show them clearly and unequivocally that our people go back way beyond that. In fact, as I said before, Charlie, we're the oldest tribe on the block. We've been there before everybody. Unless, of course, somebody can claim that they have an Edomite passport. And then, of course, we'll have to take off our hats.
And I'm trying to visualize geographically where Pekin is.
Pekin is in one of the most pastoral areas of the country. It's in the Galilee, the Western Galilee, about 5 kilometers to the northeast of Ma'alot.
Okay. So it's really quite north.
It's quite north, quite north. But it's certainly worth the visit. That's a program we fund in order to help young Israelis understand that our roots are deep and cannot be shattered.
Well, of course, for those few people who really believe in the Bible and that there is a God, and that God gave us the Torah, and in it he gave the land of Israel to the Jewish people, that's also another another quote fact. And we're lucky that we have 40 million evangelicals in America who are Bible-believing and really believe that it is the home of the Jews. And it's unfortunate that many Israelis don't believe the same thing, unfortunately.
There are different levels of patriotism in Israel, and I respect them all. There is the religious level, which I clearly have great affinity for, and there is also a secular level, which I also have great respect for, of people who say, my people, my tribe have been here for over 3,700 years. In fact, when you go to Hebron, you can actually see, when you go to the holy city of Hebron, you can actually see the gateway where, according to the Bible, Abraham, our father, purchased the first piece of Jewish real estate in the land of Israel. Those are facts. And whether one observes those facts from a religious perspective or a non-religious perspective, that's immaterial. Abraham was also a historical figure who did exist. And that's not a matter of faith. There was an Abraham, and he did buy the fields of the Machpelah in Hebron. Mm-hmm. And that land is Jewish land, and it has been. It is not a patriotic misconception that it is only the Jewish people who reached independence in the land of Israel. It is only the Jewish people who established their national character in the land of Israel. It is only the Jewish people whose language sprang up in the land of Israel, whose culture sprang up in the land of Israel. And yes, God did give us that land, no question about it. But patriotism is something of the heart, and as long as somebody addresses the issue from a patriotic perspective, being concerned about Israel's tomorrow, I'm happy.
So there is this project in Pekin, and there is the Shomrim Chadashim, the new guards.
Yes.
What other areas is your organization fostering?
Well, some of the projects that we're doing are purely educational, aside from Pekin, in order to strengthen, as I said before, the Jewish and Zionist ethos of Israel, and in order to provide young people in Israel with a sense of pride that really reflects the Jewish narrative in the land of Israel. Some of those projects are in very sensitive areas. An example of one are projects that we run in Sderot. Sderot, as all your listeners are probably aware, is a community that's very much on the front line. However, Sderot also has a very soft underbelly. A lot of the people in Sderot come from populations that are at risk, populations that are at risk of becoming permanent underclasses in the areas in which they live. For instance, in Sderot, Sderot has a large Ethiopian problem, a large Kafkazi problem. In terms of providing educational modules to young people in that town to help lift them up from poverty and to provide them the educational tools to contribute to the state and to create for themselves an economically viable and happy life. And some of the programs that we fund in Sderot seek to address the issues of poverty in Sderot, particularly because it's a frontline community and particularly because that's a community that deserves our philanthropic attention. They need our help, and they suffer daily, tremendously, and we should be helping them quickly and in an efficient manner in order to strengthen the communities that are unfortunately paying a daily price for the insanity of believing that the Arabs are going to be good neighbors.
Well, you and I were certainly inspired last night at the dinner for Sderot.
Absolutely.
It's just.
But here's another interesting field of endeavor we're getting into, Charlie, that a lot of people aren't aware of. You know, this year is the first year in Israel that 50% of the new kindergarten classes will be non-Zionist.
Non-Zionist,
which means that over 50% of the new kindergartens, and ultimately 50% of the new first grade, third grade, sixth grade classes, etc., belong either to the Arab sector or the ultra-Orthodox, non-Zionist, Haredi sector.
Really?
Now, the future of the Jews in the land of Israel depend on Jewish unity. I don't think there's anybody who'll argue that. And one of the things that the Israel Independence Fund is investigating is how can we ensure two simple things. How can we ensure greater ultra-Orthodox participation in Israel's economy? And how can we ensure greater ultra-Orthodox participation in Israel's defense? Now, a lot of folks out there say, never be done, impossible. However, there are simple solutions to those problems which haven't been brought to the attention of people here in the United States, which is a shame. As an example, we fund a project in the Golan at a wonderful, wonderful technical school called Merom, Adir BaMerom. And Adir BaMerom, which means greatness in the skies, is a technical school that works together with the Air Force. And it actually takes young people after high school, post-high school age, and trains them to be Air Force technicians. Now, they have established a sterling reputation in training, for instance, young Ethiopian immigrants and young immigrants from the former Soviet Union, and helped mentor them into permanent places in the Israeli Air Force as technicians. So when they get a job in the Israeli Air Force as technician and they get a decent salary, they're not only contributing to Israel's defense, but they're also contributing to Israel's economy. In the past year, Adir BaMerom, this technical school in the Golan Heights that we're working with, has also started to bring in young boys from B'nai B'rak.
Really?
To train them to be technicians in the Israeli Air Force, and please God, we'll see them mainstreamed as technicians in the Israel Air Force. We can double that program. This year there were 15 young men from B'nai B'rak studying there. We could double and triple that program. Now, I heard, Charlie, this is an interesting one, that UJA Federation here in New York has recently created a commission to discuss how to reach out to the Haredi world in Israel. They don't need to spend $1 million creating a mission and going to fancy hotels. What they need to do is call us. We'll give them a couple of quick solutions to the problem about how, without taking a picture of Herzl and sticking their nose in it, we can integrate the Haredi world into Israel's defense and into Israel's economy without making a big headline issue out of it and without, you know, bringing over tons of Jews from the United States to stay in fancy hotels in Jerusalem while they're investigating the issue. I once heard a great rabbi, Charlie, say that if at the time of Yitziat Mitzrayim, the exit from Egypt during the Pharaonic times,
there was a UJA federation, the first thing they would have done was condemned Moses for killing the Egyptian. And the second thing they would have done is created a commission to study the root causes of Egyptians' anti-Semitism before leaving Egypt. We don't need a commission to study the ultra-Orthodox population in Israel. They're good Jews. They're loving Jews. They're patriotic Jews. We need to reach out to them in ways that they can understand. We need to establish methods of communication with Jews who think a little bit to the left of us or a little bit to the right of us, bring them into the fold and offer them options where they could serve the country and where they could participate in the country's economy and maintain their lifestyle at the same time.
Interesting.
And it's possible and it's doable and I could prove it.
We've been talking with Aaron Pulver, who is the founder and the president of the Israel Independence Fund. And once again, what is the website for people to go to?
Our website is www.fundisrael.com.
Okay, and through that they can also contact you, tells you how to contact.
Absolutely. They can contact us and even make a contribution to one of our programs.
Got it. Okay, a few more minutes. I have a few questions. We just saw this past weekend the Nakba situation, and it's really very, in a sense, sort of frightening in a way to think of tens of thousands of Arabs trying to get through to Israel on all the fronts. What do you make of all this?
It's clear that the rules of the game are changing. However, as the rules of the game change, the primary responsibility of my government is to ensure the integrity of Israel's sovereign borders. And frankly, as an Israeli citizen and as a reservist in the IDF, I don't care how the rules of the game change. Whatever the cost, the sovereign borders of Israel must be maintained and must be defended, and we cannot have them, we cannot allow them to become porous in any manner, shape, or form. The responsibility of the government is clear. Whatever methodology it takes to ensure those borders and the sovereignty of the state of Israel, they have to work out quickly and efficiently and enforce without any mercy whatsoever, in order to maintain Israel's sovereignty without question.
It's sinful that the world doesn't allow Israel the basic rights of every other country to defend itself. Somehow or other, when Israel defends itself, it's seen as the aggressor. It's fascinating.
My son gave me an interesting perspective of that once. And he said to me, I'm obviously clearly very proud of my son, and his perspective was this, that in 1956, when Israel fought together with Britain and with France against Abdel Nasser and the Egyptian government and the Egyptian people, it was a disaster, an absolute disaster. The West's intervention and our collusion with them led to no good for Israel. Ultimately, Eisenhower forced us to leave the Sinai. A disaster. And in 1973, when we capitulated to Kissinger's demands and his salami tactics for rolling Israel back into a undefensible position began, didn't work out well for the Jews. However, in 1967, when we fought alone, tiny little Israel, mm-hmm, against the entire Arab world, and we put our faith in God, in Hashem.
Right.
Miracles happened. I would opine that there are times where we do have to go it alone, and that, in fact, might be the best route.
Well, we'll see what comes forth in the next few months. Are going to be very interesting with the possible creation of a Palestinian state, and also with the interference of our current president. I don't know that it bodes well, but we've been able to overcome quite a bit in the few years of Israel's current existence.
Israel is going to be challenged in a whole bunch of different ways in the coming months, coming years. September and this supposed so-called Palestinian independence or declaration of independence or independence that is signed off by the United Nations mm-hmm. will undoubtedly challenge Israel in many diplomatic ways and probably militarily as well. We have to reach those challenges and we have to come to conclusions based on what's good for the Jews. I think to a large extent we overcomplicate issues and we don't take a look at the simple facts. And the simple facts are that Israel's territorial integrity is of prime importance to the future of the Jewish people. And it's an issue that has to be looked at seriously, not by the talking heads on televisions in the United States or by the New York Times and their minions, but by us ourselves. We have to look within ourselves for what we firmly believe in. And we have to look at the issues in a calm and calculated and honest manner. After the Israeli retreat from Gaza, after the Israeli retreat from South Lebanon, do we really believe that empowering an additional Arab authority with more and more land, closer and closer to our population centers, is going to create a safer tomorrow for our people? If that's the case, the road is clear. However, if it's not the case, the road is also clear. And we have to take clear steps in order to ensure our own future. The Israel Independence Fund is mindful of the fact that, first and foremost, we have to educate our youth to believe in the future of the State of Israel and into the unbreakable connection of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. We also have to create an atmosphere of complete intolerance for sedition within our own country. You know what, Charlie? Often I tell people that there are actually educational modules in Israel, supported by the Israel Ministry of Education, that encourage people to question Israel's right to exist. And it includes on all age levels. Could you imagine the American government during World War II tolerating educational modules in New York City schools that were based on propaganda by the Imperial Japanese government? I mean, it's gotten so absurd that what we have to do is get back to basics. Mm-hmm. And the basics for us are simple patriotism. And the Israel Independence Fund, Charlie, is not about politics. We consider ourselves patriots. The Israel Independence Fund is a philanthropic endeavor that includes Jews of all different backgrounds and includes Jews of all different political opinions and funds Jews of all different political opinions as long as the common denominator is patriotism. We are first and foremost Jewish patriots who believe in the unbreakable connection of the Jewish people to the Jewish homeland.
Well, certainly we wish you success in all your endeavors, and I encourage my listeners to go. They're all listening on their computers listening to this program, and after you're done listening to this and some chazanis, go to www.fundisrael.com, FUND Israel.com. and learn much more about the wonderful work that Aharon Pulver and the Israel Independence Fund is doing. And we just wish you l'hatzlacha.
Thank you, Charlie. It's a pleasure to be here on your show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, that was an interview with Aharon Pulver.